Hello, everybody, and welcome back to 100 Years, 100 Movies. Today is day 27 of the Season of the Witch, and we're just about wrapping up here on our way to Halloween. Today, we're going to be talking about something more recent, and that's horror in the 2000s. Now, last time when I was talking about the 90s, I was talking about how, unfortunately, the 90s kind of dipped in overall quality for a large portion of that decade when it came to horror, and it really started to come back in the later half. Fortunately for us, that really continued in the 2000s, and we were really looking at this proliferation of new voices and this reintroduction of concepts to the world of horror. The 2000s were this goldmine of just great movies in the horror genre, everything from 28 Days Later to Frankenweenie. Actually, that might have come out after the 2000s, to Corpse Bride. You know, it was varied. There was just a lot of stuff. The 2000s gave us the introduction of torture porn, new voices like Alexander Aja and Eli Roth, among others, a reintroduction of some of the franchises that, I can't forget Rob Zombie among those, and a reintroduction of some franchises that had been beloved before, such as, you know, Halloween and Friday the 13th and Nightmare on Elm Street, and some of those weren't necessarily successful, but it's all this kind of this full embrace of horror as it was just becoming more and more profitable as the decade progressed. Now, the 2000s did have some major events that happened, and so perhaps this proliferation of horror was in relation to that. After Bill Clinton's presidency, you know, we had the whole mess with Al Gore and George W. Bush as to who would become president in the year 2000. And in 2001, of course, there was the tragedy of September 11th, which fundamentally has changed America in the ensuing 19 years. And as I've mentioned before, horror is a lot of times a way to be able to talk about those issues that are coming up in our society in a way where we may not be able to address them head on. That's not to say that every single movie was a commentary on 9/11 or on the changes that occurred in the U.S. after the Patriot Act was enacted, or a reaction to, you know, the war on terror. But at the same time, it's not to say that those things really weren't affecting what was happening in horror. But as I mentioned, horror was varied in the 2000s. There was a lot of it, and there was a lot of new voices and new people that were coming up in horror. So what that means is that we have a smattering of just different things to talk about today. Now, the first movie that I wanted to kind of highlight from the 2000s is from the year 2000, and that's American Psycho, which I think also kind of brings up another thing that was interesting about horror in 2000s was this notion of kind of taking nostalgia and putting it on its head. So we have a lot of movies that are set in an earlier time, in this case, the 80s, much like in American Psycho. In American Psycho, which is very loosely based on the Bret Easton Ellis novel, directed by Mary Harron and starring Christian Bale as Patrick Bateman, a sociopath who is a New York City investment banker in Wall Street. He is fucking insane. There's no other way around it. This is a man that kills people over having, like, he literally kills Jared Leto because he has a better business card than he does. This movie's nuts. It's great to watch. And the other really interesting thing about this is that we don't know if what we're watching is actually occurring. And that's kind of a stroke of genius because Patrick Bateman is such an unreliable narrator, and he is such a despicable person that you don't know if he really goes to the lengths of, you know, smashing Jared Leto's head in with a as he's laying down plastic all over his house, or I'm sorry, his apartment, while talking about Huey Lewis in the news, if he tried to feed a cat to an ATM and shoot it in the head, if he paid off some hookers and then killed them with a chainsaw. These things might have happened, they might not have happened, but that's part of the insanity of this movie, because if they didn't happen, then these are the crazy fantasies of a man who sees himself as above everybody else. Christian Bale is great in this. I remember reading an article once that said that The Dark Knight was a secret remake of American Psycho, and they mentioned a couple of scenes that are almost shot for shot the same. In particular, what I can think off the top of my head is the scene in American Psycho where Patrick Bateman chases these hookers down a stairwell and ends up tossing a chainsaw down the stairwell and killing one of them, which in The Dark Knight would, the equivalent scene would be the one where Batman is chasing these criminals and ends up jumping down a stairwell, landing on them to stop them. And in both cases, you know, both Bruce Wayne, Batman, and Patrick Bateman are played by Christian Bale. Now, whether or not that's true, I seriously doubt it, but it definitely makes for an interesting idea. This movie is just, it's very entertaining. It's fucking crazy. It's out there. And I think it in a way, kind of signaled some of the craziness to come, because definitely there was going to be much more gore, much more, and when I say gore, it's not like gore wasn't around in other movies, but like kind of like this mainstreaming of gore and torture and just extremeness in horror movies. And I think one of the movies that really kind of helped to kick that off is a movie that I don't care for, but a movie that I understand the importance of, and that's Saw from 2004, directed by James Wan, written by James Wan and Lee Whannell, and starring basically Lee Whannell and Cary Elwes, and secretly also starring Tobin Bell as the, I guess he's a serial killer, Jigsaw. Now, Saw did a lot of interesting things, and I understand why people really enjoy it. So Saw has this whole idea of a serial killer who basically tries to kill, and it kind of happens in the later movies, is that he's basically omniscient. Like, he sets up all these things knowing how people are going to react, which there's just too many variables. Like, I don't understand how that happens. Because there's almost like, haha, I tricked you, but no, but wait, I remembered this. It's like, I knew you were going to do that, so I did this. Like, it reminds me of this Rick and Morty episode where Rick is trying to one-up a heist by knowing that they're going to get double-crossed, so they double-crossed them to begin with, and it just ends up going to the point where there's 40-some-odd, like, double-crosses ahead because they knew what was going to happen. And I'm like, okay, that's weird. And like I said, in the first Saw, it's not as much of a problem. Although I still think it is kind of a problem, because you set up a movie wherein there really is no escape outside of sawing your own foot off, and which Cary always ends up doing. But I mean, the whole idea is that these are traps that they can come out of, and when the movie starts, the keys that would have been able to use are literally tossed down the drain because Lee Whannell doesn't understand that that's what they are, which I don't know. I feel like that's cheating. It's like a final twist, just to like, haha, get you. But I guess the final twist to haha get you is that the whole time the killer's been in the room with them. I just think this there's too many coincidences in this movie, and I don't care for it. But like I said, I mean, I understand why people really got it and really got into it, and it was so fucking popular that it burned itself out in like 6 years, which it's not the first franchise to do that. I mean, Paranormal Activity a few years later would do the same thing. Friday the 13th and Nightmare on Elm Street did that in the 80s. Scream did it within in only three movies, you know, it happens. But this movie, along with, you know, Eli Roth's movies, really kind of ended up leading to this whole idea of torture porn, which, once again, I think is being really reductive of what these movies were going for. And even something like Saw that I don't care for, I don't really think that the main focus was just, hey, let's try to be as horrific as we can. There's definitely a sense of one-upsmanship amongst these directors, but that's not to say that they're just trying to gross people out, or they're just trying to push things as much as they can, There's usually a narrative reason for it, and I think that a lot of times people who aren't used to seeing those extremes can be put off by them. And that's not to say that everyone has to be okay with watching extremely gruesome horror movies or extremely graphic or gory ones. It's just when something can be extremely gruesome or gory and it ends up hitting the zeitgeist, there's going to be a backlash. It's just going to happen. Now, another movie that kind of has a similar idea to Saw and Hostel is The Strangers from 2008. In The Strangers, we follow Scott Speedman and Liv Tyler as a boyfriend and girlfriend couple who, at the very beginning of the movie, we get the idea that Scott Speedman has proposed to Liv Tyler and she said no. And they're on their way back home, and these people show up asking for someone like Alice or something like that, which of course isn't there. As the movie progresses, these three masked kids, because they look like they're, you know, younger than them, maybe in their 20s, start to little by little basically invade their house and put them in psychological torture situations. Like, there is scenes of like them being tortured, but more it's like playing mind games with them. This was a movie that kind of blindsided me. I didn't think it was going to be that interesting, that entertaining. When I saw this, I just thought, oh, this is going to be like, just, you know, I can just sit back and relax and there'll be some gore at some point, and then that'll be that. And sometimes, you know, that's enough for me, but I ended up being really I guess impressed by what this movie did, and by kind of how it was able to really have this sense of dread and make me actually care for these characters. And we basically just have these two people that we follow the whole time and trying to see them survive, and kind of in our back of our heads knowing that they're not going to. That's, and it makes for a very interesting movie, at least for me. This was like a low-key great movie to watch that just kind of came out of nowhere. And I really enjoyed it. And it was something that, like I said, I wasn't expecting. Now, that's not to say, I add a caveat. So, as I said, this is something in the vein of like Saw or Hostel. So there is definitely a lot of gruesome shit in this movie. It's not for everybody, but if you like your movies a bit more raw, a bit more out there, then you'll probably enjoy this. And I think the ending line of this is like chilling, because we have this character, Liv Tyler basically asking why they're doing this, and their answer is because you were home. The implication being that they'll do this to anybody. And that's even more chilling than what's happening on screen. Now, speaking of movies that kind of blew me away, another movie in 2008 that really was great and that I didn't know what I was kind of getting myself into, and didn't know what to expect when I saw it, was Thomas Alfredson's Let the Right One In. Let the Right One In is basically this vampire story from the point of view of a young boy, Oscar, who he's kind of a lonely kid who gets bullied a lot. His mom is always working, so he's by himself. He ends up meeting this girl in his apartment building, who is her name's Ellie, and you know, he only sees her a couple of times, but he becomes very fascinated with her, and he doesn't realize that she's actually a vampire. And Ellie looks like a 12-year-old girl. As the movie progresses, we get to know, learn more about her. We find out, for example, that the man that she lives with, who we assume is her, it's almost comedic in how like pathetic it is. And because he's so bad at it, eventually the authorities get involved and he has to end up basically sacrificing himself in order to protect Ellie. Now, Oscar doesn't know all this, and Oscar really kind of enjoys her company, and as he gets to know more and more about her, one day he ends up seeing her attack someone and becomes frightened of her. Ellie, having a friend once again, wants him to kind of give her another chance, and we kind of have this whole interplay of kind of playing with the rules of vampires. So like there's a scene where, you know, he's like, she's outside, he's like, you need to let me in, or you need to invite me in. And he's like, what happens if I don't invite you in? And she's like, I don't know. And he basically is like, all right, well, he says, I'm not going to invite you in. Like, I want to know what's going to happen. And so she steps into his house, and within a few seconds, she just starts bleeding like crazy. Oscar freaks out and is like, no, get back. You can come in. And this whole idea of a vampire not being able to come into your house unless you invite them in is something that's like seen in like Salem's Lot and probably in Dracula even. It's something that comes up a lot in vampire stories. So it's interesting to see that. As he tries to get to know more about her, you know, she doesn't really know anything. And that ambiguity as to what her background is makes it more chilling. And as the movie progresses and the Oscar becomes more and more friendly with her, to the point where Ellie ends up killing the bullies that are tormenting him, and he runs off with her, we realize that he's basically making a pact with her, much like Hakan, the man that lived with her, did. He probably also met Ellie as a young boy and has been spending his natural life protecting her. And we get the sense that Oscar's going to be doing the same thing. And that's even more horrific than everything that we've seen so far in the movie. Let the Right One In is amazing. It was remade in 2010 here in America by, I believe, Matt Reeves, starring Chloe Grace Moretz as the Ellie character. And as it was called Let Me In. They changed the title somewhat. It's still pretty good, but if you're going to watch either one of these, I would say definitely go for the original. The original is better. It's much better made. And it's a very interesting movie and a very different take on vampires than what we've seen a lot of times. Now, one of the other things that kind of started in the 2000s, and this isn't something related specifically to horror, and that's mumblecore. Mumblecore was a movement in independent films where we had these movies from the point of view of a lot of 20-somethings in New York, mostly cisgendered white, and a lot of them had to do with kind of relationship troubles. I am not the biggest fan of mumblecore, but just like anything, mumblecore has a subgenre called mumblegore, and one of the best directors of that bunch is Ty West. And Ty West directed one of my favorite movies of the 2000s, and that's The House of the Devil, a movie that, much like American Psycho, is a throwback to the 1980s. It's set during 1983, and we follow Samantha, a college student who is struggling to make ends meet and takes on a babysitting gig in order to get some fast cash so she can pay for have her first month's rent for an apartment that she wants to get. Now, the House of the Devil is basically a throwback to something like Rosemary's Baby. It has that same energy, and this is a movie that is masterful in the anticipation. This is a movie where if you're just looking for straight-up gore or straight-up jump scares, you're going to be very, very, very disappointed, because there's basically three scenes that you would probably consider as straight-up horror. Most of this movie is playing with tone and playing with this sense of dread from the anticipation of something happening. that's going to be horrific and that's going to put Samantha in danger. And for the majority of this movie, that doesn't happen. Although, as the audience, we know that there's something wrong. And Samantha's not stupid. She also knows that there's something off with this place. But she's basically willing to take that chance in order to make ends meet. Much like many people in the 80s who weren't necessarily dealing with Satanists that they were babysitting. But that were doing what they needed to do in order to make ends meet. Much like people today. And that's kind of the brilliance of this movie. It's a movie where you can literally say, well, nothing happens up until the last 10 minutes. But by seeing that, you're basically missing the point of what the movie is doing. And it's really cool to see that in 2009, because this is something that just really isn't done. Or at the time really wasn't done. We unfortunately are getting more movies like that, and we've gotten more movies like that since. And that's not to say that this is something completely novel, but something that was a bit more mainstream than other movies that would try this really is interesting to see, and really, for me at least, is something that I really enjoy. Now, as I keep going back to, there's been all these new voices in horror in this time period, and another one of those is Neil Marshall. And his best movie was 2005's The Descent. The Descent is, the easiest way to think of it is basically, what if aliens, but, or alien, but in an underground cave? The Descent, the really interesting thing about it is that it's basically this drama of this group of friends, one who was traumatized by the loss of her daughter and husband, after an accident. Her friends basically decide to go spelunking in order to kind of get her out of her, kind of shake things up and kind of get her out of her grief for a little bit. They end up trying to, they entice her by saying it's going to be just something really simple, but one of them decides, unbeknownst to the others, that they're going to actually go into this undiscovered area of caves and kind of discover it themselves. However, as they go deeper into the cave, they not only run into issues of getting lost, getting disoriented, and these things that are hunting you, that want to kill you, and it's bleak as all fuck. And the original ending of this movie, which was changed here in America because we're a bunch of fucking pussies over here, is basically the main character. Because as they progress, all these women basically are killed off. And Sarah, the main character, at the very end, she escapes. And she's able to get back up to the surface and is able to get help. And in the American version, that's where the movie ends. But in the original British version, Sarah, after she escapes, Sarah wakes up and she's in the cave, all alone, with dwindling supplies. And then she starts hallucinating that she is with her daughter, as it's heavily implied that these creatures have found her and are about to kill her. The Descent is fucking amazing. It's great. It's one of the best movies of the decade. And if you haven't seen it, do yourself a favor and check it out. Now, not all of the original voices that came out in the 2000s were great, which leads me to Jeepers Creepers, which is a really fun movie, but unfortunately, the creator of it is a pedophile, so there's that. Jeepers Creepers itself stars Justin Long and Gina Phillips as a brother and sister who end up on a road trip and are being followed by the Creeper, this creature that's this bat-like demon creature that eats people's eyes. Jeepers Creepers is amazing as long as you don't think about the production of it and the people behind it. This Slay. Now, there's plenty of horror movies around Christmas, but I wanted to spotlight this one in particular because this is the only horror movie where you're going to have Santa Claus played by professional wrestler Bill Goldberg. Bill Goldberg, who from his name you can tell is Jewish. This movie starts off with this ridiculous scene where Santa Claus shows up at a family dinner for Christmas that has James Caan, Fran Drescher, and Chris Kattan, who are all Jewish. There's, I believe, Rebecca Gayheart is also there as well. He shows up and mercilessly kills everyone there. The whole backstory of this movie is that Santa Claus is actually a demon. He's the son of Satan, and he lost a curling competition to an angel, and has therefore, in order to repent, has had to be good for 1,000 years. But that 1,000 years is coming up, and so Santa is coming to town to fucking kill everybody. This movie is basically just a joke, but it's a very fun one. This is a movie where we have Bill Goldberg spearing someone, which was of course one of his finishing moves in wrestling, it's basically a tackle. He spears someone through a glass case. He also impales someone with a menorah. He doesn't have reindeer. He rides a giant bison. This movie's a lot of fun. It's fucking dumb. If you've never heard of it, you should check it out. This is not well acted. This is not well done. But this is the kind of movie where in one sequence, someone shines a light in Bill Goldberg's eyes, and his response is, "I'm Santa Claus, not fucking Dracula." So that kind of gives you an idea of the level of ridiculousness that you're dealing with in this movie. Santa Slay is great. The 2000s in general were a great time for horror, and there's just a lot of great stuff to look into there, you know, and a lot of things you can really dive into and really enjoy. And that's going to continue in the following decade when we get to the 2010s. But as far as the 2000s, there's plenty to enjoy. That's it for today, and we'll be back tomorrow.